time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and on today's episode, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Steve Carstensen. He is a primary care dentist who focuses on breathing and sleep. So welcome, Dr. Carstensen.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I'm really excited to have a chance to talk with you.
Great, and I'm really glad to have you here because we have not had the opportunity to speak with a dentist yet, and I know some of the listeners are probably wondering, what has a dentist got to do with sleep? And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So why don't I start off and let you tell us, why dentist? What have you got to do with sleep?
Sure. Well, we have to go back in history a bit, because when sleep medicine was being discovered, really, they could identify people who weren't breathing well while they sleep, but they had very little ideas of what to do with it until, of course, Dr. Sullivan invented the CPAP machine, where they discovered, well, if we inflate the airway behind the tongue a little bit, we can keep people's airway from collapsing. Well, right about the same time, some dentists and a physician were looking at this going, well, wait a minute, if the tongue is a problem, then what if we just hold the tongue forward? So an ear, nose, and throat physician in Germany actually came up with this idea to hold the tongue forward. And right after that, right about the same time, a dentist and a physician colleague in Albuquerque were looking at this thinking, wait a minute, I took a CPR class that told me to hold the chin forward. What if we did that through the nighttime? What would that mean? And so they worked up a couple of oral devices that fit over the teeth and held the jaw forward, and lo and behold, the patient breathed better through the nighttime. And as that was worked up, oral appliances were first looked at in publishing around 1984, which is the same time that CPAPs came around. And so actually dentists have had ways to help people breathe better for as long as they've had CPAPs.
Wow.
So the difference is that, you know, CPAPs were invented by a PhD and then worked into medicine really fast. Dentists and physicians, unfortunately, have been isolated from each other in terms of overlapping diseases for way too long. And because of that, as physicians were looking at this new disease of sleep apnea and thinking about what can we do about this, they didn't really think about reaching out to dental colleagues who were also looking at it and thinking what we can do to help out. So they didn't intertwine very well in the 80s and the early 90s when this whole thing was becoming a part of medicine.
Right.
Well, but lots of people were given CPAPs from the early days, the terrible ones, to the latest days, which are the great ones, and they still struggle with them. So instead of giving up on treatment, then patients can go see a dentist who's trained, and then all of a sudden there's something else to do. In 2011, 2015, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine's new protocols or updated protocols included dental sleep medicine as part of every treatment option for physicians to decide, well, what's good for my patients here?
Right.
Notice that's 2015. That's, you know, 20 years after this became more common treatment. It took a while to catch up. And then CMS, Medicare, came along and said, wait a minute, dentists can be part of this as well. And that was a big breakthrough.
Right.
And it gave us legitimacy for dealing with all of this as colleagues. So dentists get involved because of the, first off, they got involved because of the troubles of keeping people on CPAPs.
Right. Yeah. You know, so I've been doing a lot of research of my own, and what I have found is kind of shocking, which is, and the numbers are kind of all over the place, but generally the numbers that I've seen are anywhere from 50 as high as 80% of people who are prescribed a CPAP either never start using it or start using it and within the first week or two stop using it because they either are not comfortable with it or some other issue. And so you have a lot of people who know they have obstructive sleep apnea. They know they need to treat it, but they're not using the treatment that's prescribed. So are you saying that the dental appliances are something different than a CPAP? So a person would not need a CPAP if the dental appliance works?
It's a complex issue. It's not simply either or. On the surface, it kind of seems that way because there's really only two effective non-invasive treatments for a closing airway during the nighttime. One of them is CPAP, and I know your audience knows this, but it's the continuous positive air pressure. It's a pressure mask, got a little hose, got a little airflow generator. They used to be noisy and clunky. Now they're small and quiet. But the troubles that come with that, with air flowing into your nose all the time, the science is showing us that some people's sleep patterns don't match up well with a constant flow of air through their nose. Mm-hmm. There are signals to the brain that come from airflow through the nose that can interrupt sleep. And some signals are necessary for the brain to know that it's time to sleep. Some signals go into parts of the brain that keep sleep organized and through its normal cycles. So that's important information. Mm-hmm. But some signals go to the part of the brain that wakes people up. And when we have this artificial flow on some of those individuals, they unfortunately have worse sleep qualities. So directly into the brain, we have some people that are susceptible to poor sleep because of a CPAP. You put an oral appliance in and there's no additional sensory input. Mm-hmm. Once you have it in place and you just kind of jut your chin forward, you can mimic what we do. Then once you get used to doing that, that's kind of normal. You don't feel it any different than Andrew. You feel your headphones. I mean, they're there. You can notice them if you want to, but they kind of fade into the background. Mm-hmm. And CPAP never quite does that. So the scientists are learning that there are specific parts of our population that match better to CPAPs than not, and more so the ones that don't match well to CPAP. Now, that hasn't filtered down into everyday practice as near as much as I think it will in the future.
Right. So, you know, I'm curious because I have not done the research in this area in terms of the dental appliances. If we take the research that I've done that shows that the CPAPs are not well implemented by people who have them, do you know any numbers or data related to dental appliances? Do people gravitate to those more, or is it the same issue of them not being comfortable with them?
Well, you know, I wish I could say there was any treatment for any medical condition that was universal, mm-hmm. but there's not, and sleep is no different. And so what we have is we have one very effective treatment, CPAP, that is used poorly. And statistics, like you learned, range all over the scope. If you look at some statistics, 30% of people can use them well. If you ask a sleep physician, it's be more like 90% because it's very difficult in a clinical setting. And I'm a clinician. I see patients regularly every week. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to gather the adequate statistics because people don't actually call us and say, look, I'm not using your treatment anymore.
Right.
You know,
right.
We find that out later on. The advantage we have with the electrical devices like CPAP is that they report to the cloud now. Mm-hmm. And so data can be gathered from these machines about how effective they're being used. And that's part of the insurance game as well.
Right.
Whereas oral appliances have no connection to the cloud. And so we have to rely on self-report. Mm-hmm. When they've done these studies, they find over and over and over again that patients prefer the oral appliances, and they tend to report that they're using it 60, 80, 90% of the time up to a year later. Mm-hmm. And the longest studies are going 5 years and 15 years now. And more than half the people, 60, 70% of people, are using the appliances the way we prescribe them every night. That compares very favorably to really any part of medicine, like even hypertension medications. Mm-hmm. Are being used about that same level. So we compare favorably.
So as you can tell, I'm big into data and statistics and evidence on this show. So in terms of the people who are prescribed an oral appliance, do you know any data in terms of what percentage of those people get the improvement that is expected?
That, there's a couple of studies that are actually many studies now have compared head-to-head CPAPs and oral appliances. Mm-hmm. And what's evolving also, Andrew, is how do we define disease? Mm-hmm. Because in the early days, when the sleep apnea was first being labeled, brought up with a code, having an official medical designation, because sleep apnea, by definition, is just stopping breathing. We've seen that for a long, long, long time in medicine. But only in the 70s and 80s was it actually codified to where there's a, you know, descriptions. So when we start, when Dr. Guillemineau and Dr. Dement define this disease, they identified events of stopping breathing, events of less breathing. And they counted up those events and they divided by the time that they were observing, and they called that an index, an apnea hypopnea index. And Dr. Guillemineau realized a few years later that that was an ineffective description of the problem. As science has moved on, we've realized that the event count, although it's necessary, is inadequate to fully express the physiologic impact. So as we think about now, what is effective treatment? If we consider only reducing the number of events, then CPAP will always win because it can effectively reduce the events to zero. Oral appliances rarely do that. But so if we scoreboard just event reduction, CPAP wins. Okay. But the science is now showing, and multiple studies are showing, effects on blood pressure, effects on insulin resistance, effects effects on quality of life, brain responses. There's not any difference between oral appliance effectiveness and CPAP effectiveness over time.
Great, great. Wow. So, yeah, it's really interesting that the whole sort of field, as you referred to it earlier, of sleep medicine is really very, very new compared to much other medical information. And it's also one of those unique areas where, as you said, not only do you have physicians, but you have dentists, you have therapists, you have a lot of different disciplines all working together because there's so many pieces of this. So, you know, I think what I'd like to do is I want to get some more information, talk about what these oral devices actually look like and how they work. But before we do that, I'm going to take a quick break for commercial and we'll be right back to talk about the sleep appliances.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
All right, we are back on Sleep Science Today with Dr. Steve Carstensen, and we were just about to talk about what these oral appliances look like before break. So, Dr. Carstensen, can you explain what, you know, people hear the word dentist, and, you know, you chose the profession. It's one of those where people get scared, right? They always think of pain when they think of a dentist, but it's not always true. There's a lot of dental procedures that are not painful, but what does an oral appliance look like? Is it something scary and painful, or is it something more manageable?
It's, well, okay. So what we have to think about first, let's think about what we're dealing with here. We have an airway that begins at the outside of the nose, goes through the nose, goes over the back of the palate, goes behind the tongue, and then down into the trachea or the hard, the non-collapsible portion that goes to our lungs. the parts above the trachea, above our voice box, actually, are the collapsible part. And we know this, patients. Anybody listening to this can mimic this by pushing their tongue forward and really realizing how it breathes, and then kind of pulling their tongue back and next realizing it, they can't breathe as well. So the part of the face that can move is the lower jaw. Think about it. We can't move our nose. We can't move our upper jaw, but we can move our lower jaw. Mm-hmm. And a lot of soft tissue parts are attached to the lower jaw. So if we can move the lower jaw forward, we carry the base of the tongue forward as well, and that's away from the back of the throat, hopefully staying open then through all the mechanisms of breathing. Mm-hmm. So why dentists are involved is because dentists have been relegated the mastery of the lower face,
okay,
of the teeth, of the gums, of the movement of the lower jaw, the health of the jaw joint, those kind of things. Physicians did almost no training in that part of the body.
Mm-hmm.
So physicians who might be diagnosing these sleep apnea problems can't apply one of the treatments because they have no expertise in fitting something accurately to the teeth or dealing with a feedback from the patients of using this new device. Mm-hmm. So we're going to hold the lower jaw forward. We're going to like push the chin out and keep it there several hours, as long as people are sleeping. There's more than 150 FDA cleared devices to do that very thing.
Wow.
They all basically do the same thing with different mechanisms, different ways of holding the jaw forward, different means of attaching to the teeth, all kinds of variations. But I've got a couple of examples here for you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if I can hold it up to the camera and make this look right. So this is one, and this is the upper. It goes on over the upper teeth. You can see it fits precisely over the upper teeth, so it feels comfortable and secure.
Let me stop you for 1 second there just to make the audience aware. So I realize some of you are listening on radio, but we do have this on YouTube and you will be able to see the actual pictures. But what Dr. Carstensen is holding right now, to me, kind of looks like a mouth guard maybe that you would use in sports.
Exactly. Yeah, think about it like a custom fitted, very kind of snugly fitted, but comfortable night guard for both arches at the same time.
Okay.
And then this particular mechanism, thank you for reminding me that we're on the radio as well, because I'm looking at you on the screen, and
right,
you guys watching on YouTube will see this little interaction later on. but we, on this particular design, the upper has a little wire to it and the lower has a little hook to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, the upper jaw supports the lower jaw, and the lower jaw is held together by this little hook.
It's okay, like so
backwards.
So just describing then for the audience. So if you can imagine a mouth guard that you might use for wrestling or football or any sort of sports, you've got an upper piece and you've got a lower piece that looks similar. But the difference here is there is a hook that applies that pushes the lower jaw forward a little bit so that when you close your mouth together with these devices in place, your lower jaw is going to be pulled forward.
Right. And prevented from falling backwards. Because when we're asleep at nighttime, the muscles relax everywhere, including around our throat, which allows us to have sleep apnea, but also that carries the lower jaw. And so if the lower jaw falls backwards or open or both, then the airway is compromised.
Mm-hmm.
So by holding the lower jaw forward and closed, we not only promote nasal breathing, but we also are able to keep that base of tongue from collapsing into the throat. And there's a little bit of an effect on the palate as well, because there's some connections there that we can use.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, like I said, there's over 150 designs. That's one of them that works especially well. And that particular one has been supported by very, very good science for years and years and years. Pardon me. I know I'm not supposed to use a lot of name brands here, but that one is called a TAP appliance. And just for my background, Dr. Thornton, who invented that one, is one of the pioneers of the whole part of dental sleep medicine. He's in Dallas. He's still practicing. And he mentored me and many, many other people. Now I get to be the education director for his company because I just believe in him and I believe in the concept and I believe in that particular appliance.
Great.
Another example looks like this. So again, almost all of them look like mouth guards, like you might think of, but not like the ones you might get at the store because these are custom fitted. That's where dentists come in, trained dentists come in, because that's part of what we can do is we can fit things very well to the teeth, making sure it's comfortable for you, the patient, and also safe because it can't push on the gums. It can't push too much on that tooth or that or this other tooth. And then when we hold the jaw forward at nighttime, at first, what I tell patients all the time is at first, you're likely to feel a little bit of feedback from the muscles, like a new exercise or a new machine at the gym would cause.
Right.
No different than that. And by when we gain flexibility in those areas, that discomfort goes away. But the bigger problem that dentists have and the patients feel sometimes is that when you get up in the morning and you take this forward posturing device out, well, your jaw is still forward because you've been there for several hours.
Right.
And so what the advantage that trained dentists have is that they can guide the patient back to the where their jaw goes back to their normal position and their teeth come back together and their bite feels the same. Physicians can't do that, and you can't do that over from Amazon. And so the professional input there, it helps maintain the current bite, the comfortable bite, deals with any potential individual side effects that people have when they wear these devices. Folks that get in trouble are the ones that go to an untrained dentist, so they're not really familiar with what they're doing, or they try on their own. And they don't seek out the advice. So I'm not trying to over-pitch, you know, dentistry is critical, but I kind of am because it's really very, very helpful that way.
Right.
Yeah, and yeah.
Well, let me ask this piece, because if I have the question, I would assume some of the audience has the question as well. So if someone is wearing an oral appliance, like the ones that you showed, is there a difference between a nose breather and a mouth breather? In other words, would a mouth breather be able to use an oral appliance like that?
Andrew, I love that you asked that question because, first of all, I got to say, nose breathing is the way we're intended to breathe. And we'll come back to that in a second. But yeah, the appliances will almost all allow mouth breathing if necessary, which is important because we get we have colds. You know, like I'm just getting over one. My voice is a little rough. And when I'm there, it is. when I have my cold at the height, you know, I couldn't breathe through my nose. And so if that was the if we didn't have a second way to breathe, then we'd all, you know, we wouldn't survive, right? So, so we have to be able to breathe through our mouth, and all the appliances allow that. That being said, it's much, much healthier to breathe through your nose. There's tons of reasons. We can go on. I can go on and on. I have whole lectures, days of lectures about nose breathing. So the short answer is, well, let me tell you a story. I was up in Fairbanks, Alaska, and I was there in January because that's when dentists want to have their classes because they don't have outdoor sports in January in Fairbanks, Alaska. And it was minus 10 degrees. I went for a hike with my friend at about minus 5 degrees. Okay, I'm out there, and when it's minus 5 degrees, the cold air is very dry. When I was breathing in through my nose, by the time that minus 5 degree zero humidity air reached the top of my palate, it was full body temperature. It was 100% humidified, and it was clean. That's what the power of the nose is. If I breathe through my mouth, that cold, dry, unfiltered air reaches my lungs, which is not healthy.
Right.
And so the nose is critical for our overall health. There's some fascinating things that signal the brain when you're breathing through your nose that doesn't happen when you're breathing through your mouth. And so the way the brain perceives our environment is much different when we're breathing through our nose. And we want to have a calm, restful sleep, which means we want to send the right signals to our brain while we're sleeping.
Right.
Although the appliances allow mouth breathing, in any responsible clinic, responsible is a value term I use. We must emphasize nose breathing, and it's critically important for that.
So let me stop there and ask another question that I'm sure some audience members have. I can imagine.
Pardon me. Sure. Let me finish that thought because I reached my resource.
Okay.
The Guys Have a Red Breath by James Nestor.
Okay.
That is an amazing book.
So you're holding up a book. The title of the book is Breath, B-R-E-A-T-H, and the author is James Nestor, N-E-S-T-O-R, correct?
Correct.
Great.
Yeah, James is a... he put himself through several tests he calls heinous just so he could write about it. And in my clinic, I say everybody that breathes should read that book. Because it talks so much about the value of nose breathing, the value of breathing in general, the way the pattern of breathing that we have that makes things much more healthy.
Okay. So let me ask the question then that I think some people may have. You're talking about how nose breathing is the sort of preferred over mouth breathing. You gave us the reasons. But what do you say to the patient who says, well, yeah, doc, that's great, but I don't make that choice. I'm asleep, and I just, you know, how am I going to make that change?
Right. Well, we can help people change habits through the daytime as well. So we can give them some exercise, a real simple exercise to make them better nose breathers. The body wants to breathe through the nose. That's the natural order. So if we can make that more common by giving them a device that tends to hold their mouth closed, but doesn't prevent mouth opening.
Mm-hmm.
So so the body's going to breathe somehow. It's going to mm-hmm. make air come in. If it can't breathe through the nose, it'll open the mouth. If we give an appliance that keeps the mouth closed, it'll still find a way to open the mouth if it needs to. That's okay. That's good. But if we can make this easier by using a medication, by using an exercise, sometimes what we do is we actually have people put a little piece of tape across their lips just to keep their lips from passively falling open. So they're when they're asleep, they don't just flop open. That increases the habit of nose breathing. Mm-hmm. And when you establish a good habit that way, then the lip taping is not always necessary. And there's some accessories that we can use as well that help to seal up the mouth, not in a permanent way, of course, but only in a way that promotes the good habit of nose breathing. But it does take some work, take some emphasis. I ask people, how do you get ready for sleep? You brush your teeth, yes. Do you floss, rinse? They'll tell the dentist they floss. And I said, what about your nose? How do you get your nose ready for sleep? And, you know, they just look at me, I don't know what that means, and which is the most common answer. And what we're trying to do now is they get your nose ready for sleep also. So you blow your nose, and if you need a little saline rinse or some other little thing in your nose to make sure that that's open, then that's a good thing to do at nighttime. I have a couple of rinses I recommend to people, and they spray one little bit in each nostril, and that just gets their nose ready for sleep the same way they get their mouth ready for sleep.
Mm-hmm. Great, great. Okay, so I have another question for you that follows up from this, which deals with the concept of snoring. But before we get there, we're going to take another quick commercial break, and we'll be right back with Dr. Steve Carstensen.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So this is Andrew Kolsky with Dr. Steve Carstensen on Sleep Science Today. We are talking about oral appliances and breathing issues. We have talked about different oral appliances for obstructive sleep apnea. And I want to follow up now with a question about snoring. So let me ask you this. So if someone is using one of these oral appliances and they happen to snore a lot, will this have any impact on their actual snoring?
Most of the time, what I tell people is that it will reduce snoring to where it's not a social problem. Because making a little bit of breathing sounds, if the oxygen levels to the brain are maintained, if the airway pattern is good to where it's not interrupting sleep, and you make a little snoring sounds, then the person who's making the sounds has to determine if that's a social problem for them or not. Mm-hmm. And if we have a good open airway, proper physiology, and just a little noise, there's some additional things that can be done. Lasers on pallets. There's electrical signals that can be sent to the tissues to make them stronger. Several different things can be done about snoring. But what we want to do is we want to eliminate the possibility of having that being a physiologic problem as well.
Mm-hmm.
A good friend of mine, you probably should be on your podcast, named Dave McCarty, wrote a book called Empowered Sleep Apnea. And one of his reasons to treat, he calls it, is snoring, because it's such a big social problem. And we know that snoring keeps the bed partner's sleep to be poor quality as well.
Right.
So what we have to do is eliminate that impact on a bed partner, eliminate that impact on social quality of life. For example, you can't take a trip with your friends. Mm-hmm. And those kind of things are all issues that are worthy of treatment. Mm-hmm. So what we tell people with oral appliances is most of the time, getting the airway open will also reduce the snoring to the point where it's not a problem for you, but let us know if it is. And then as you are able to keep your airway open for months at a time, now after years of having a disturbed airway, then the inflammation in your airway and your palate and other parts that surround that breathing area, well, the inflammation will decrease, mm-hmm. which tightens up the tissues, which makes you quieter. And so the effect sometimes carries on takes a few months to fully resolve.
Right. So, you know, another sort of side question here, and I don't want to derail us, but I am curious. You were talking about some of the other treatments for snoring. Let's assume we're not talking about obstructive sleep apnea. We just happen to, you know, someone comes to the dentist and they mention the fact that they have this issue with snoring and their bed partner is getting annoyed with it. Right. These types of other treatments, are those things that dentists do, or is that something that they would go to a physician for?
Well, that brings up the bigger picture point, and I'll answer that for sure, is that most of the time what we need to think about is that sleep-related breathing problems are oftentimes not treated with one therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So CPAP doesn't do everything. Oral appliances don't do everything. Ear, nose, and throat otolaryngologists can't do everything. But we all work together to make it happen. Mm-hmm. So if we identify, for example, a palate that is long and floppy because it's been subject to being beat up by snoring for decades. Well, just holding the jaw forward may not be totally effective there. So we can tighten that tissue. And one way of doing that is with lasers now. Mm-hmm. So there's a procedure called NightLase, which is one company's brand, but there's several laser companies. And lasers have been used in medicine for a long, long time, used in dentistry for a long, long time. And now what we have realized is we can go to the palate tissue and we can tighten that tissue inside the tissue non-invasively, basically. It's not like cutting it away.
Right.
And that tighter palate will vibrate less. Hmm. Now, and if you combine that with holding the airway open so we have a smooth air flow, that can be a fairly persistent treatment. In other words, it lasts a long time.
Right.
Sometimes it has to be redone every year, kind of like Botox. You know, you get Botox for something, then you have to get Botox again for the same thing a few months later, depending on how your body processes it. Same kind of thing for lasers on palates.
Mm-hmm.
We also work very closely with our ear, nose, and throat colleagues because we deal with the airway from the outside of the nose all the way to the top of the voice box. Mm-hmm. So that means that from here to here, that's the province of our otolaryngology friends. And they look for restrictions in that. They look for tissues that can be shrunk. And there's multiple ways of doing that. Surgery is one, radio frequency things, lasers. They do all kinds of things there too. And to make sure this breathing tube here is optimally working, mm-hmm. as well. Yeah.
Wow.
We can measure that in our dental offices and in our ENT offices. We have a machine called a rhinomanometer that actually measures airflow through the nose. And so we can tell whether the people can breathe well through their nose or not.
Right. So putting it in practical terms for the listener, if you're one of those people who's been kicked out of your bed because you snore too loud, there's actually a lot of options available for you that might get you to be able to return to your own bedroom.
The most dangerous part is people who assume that snoring is benign. Mm-hmm. Sure, it's a problem for my bed partner, but you know, everybody does this. You know, and if they want to go live in the other room, okay, that's fine. But the difficulty is that while not everybody that snores has sleep apnea and physiologic challenges to their brain health, most people do mm-hmm. some level. And then the other thing they're discovering that's really fascinating to me, Andrew, is side effects. So if you snore a lot, and I apologize for my voice.
Sure.
If you snore a lot, then it actually vibrates the blood vessels in your neck. And you're more likely to have atheromas in your neck, so hardening of the arteries or potential stroke problems just from snoring.
Wow.
So it's a serious thing to look into.
So, you know, following up on that, because that's an interesting point as well. But so if I am just, you know, the average person going home, going to work, going to bed every day, is there a simple way for me to become more aware of whether or not I have any of these issues?
Well, we recommend a simple app called SnoreLab, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of these apps out there, but one of them simple is called SnoreLab. And that one, the free version is fine. The paid version gets you a little bit more data. And what that does is that listens to you while you sleep, and then you can determine how much noise you're making and also listen for pauses. And both those things can really give you a little bit of a window into it. But testing these days used to be sleep testing was a big burdensome thing. You go to the hospital, there's 27 different things attached to you. It's not like that anymore. Most of the time it's a thing on your finger, sometimes a couple of things attached to you. But it's not very difficult to get a sleep test run these days. And those are done at your house. So in your natural environment. Now, it's still a different thing to do, but it's not burdensome or expensive anymore. And so we can find out a lot more. There's no reason to be afraid of a sleep test because of two reasons. Well, first of all, it doesn't cost, well, several reasons. It doesn't cost as much. It's easier to use. And it doesn't always end up in CPAP. Mm-hmm. My primary care physician friends have told me that they stop asking about sleep to their patients because too many times the people would say, well, I don't want to have a sleep test because I don't want to have a CPAP. Well, most sleep physicians these days are considering more than just CPAP as optional treatment.
Right. And can you just tell us real briefly, if someone does have obstructive sleep apnea and they're avoiding the sleep test because they don't want the CPAP and so on and so forth, if you don't treat obstructive sleep apnea, what are the concerns, if any?
Sure. Well, they're highly connected with cardiovascular disease. So we have a intermittent hypoxia problem, which means your oxygen levels fluctuate up and down in your blood system. Your brain hates that. And so it tries to combat that by changing how your cardiovascular system responds. Mm-hmm. So we end up with a rapid heart rate. We end up with a higher blood pressure. We end up with eventually something called insulin resistance, which has to do with cardiovascular health as well as kidney health and liver health and all kinds of body parts that are affected. And so we have a cascading physiologic challenge when we don't breathe properly. Breathing is our first reflex. It's the first thing that happens when we're born. It's a thing we have to do frequently. We can go without eating and breathing. We can go without eating and drinking and even sleeping for a while, but we can't go anytime without breathing.
Right.
So that's the fundamental of our physiology. Mess with that and we mess with the rest of us, every cell. Mm-hmm. So the longer in life you go on with a breathing problem, the more chances you're going to have of a chronic disease. And then those can, depending on your whole body physiology, can cascade into heart attacks and strokes and high blood pressure and diabetes and glaucoma and all kinds of troubles that because we can't breathe well. So what we also want to do
gives me an opening to say this, is that we want to get involved as early in life as possible, Andrew, in making people breathe better. So dentists are also the masters of the growth of this part of the face. Mm-hmm. We're the ones that pay attention to how the little ones are growing. Right. And so if we can identify early in life, and that's where dentistry is going, is to see, okay, what are the bad habits? What are the bad growth patterns? What are the bad things that are happening at 3, 4, and 5 years old that we can keep people from becoming 30, 40, and 50 with chronic disease? Mm-hmm. And so some more resources for your audience. The best one for anybody to read, I mentioned breath as everybody should read. The right. best one for any parent, any family to read is by, I'm holding it up now again, and you can read it or I can read it, but Dr. Shireen Lim, L-I-M, wrote a book called Breathe, Sleep, Thrive. Okay. And there's not a better book for anybody to read.
Can you spell the author's name? Shireen?
Sure. Is it Shireen. It's S-H-R-E-E-N-L-I-M. Shireen Lim.
Great.
She's a primary care dentist in Perth, Australia. A good friend. And she has just had valuable lessons for her patient families, and she put them all in a book. And it's just a fantastic book for any family. So it has, you know, any little ones, and not just infants for that one, but for any ones. There's multiple resources out there. I have tons of them. I can give them to you, and then you can post them up with your YouTube if you want.
That'd be great. Yeah, we can definitely do that. So, you know, we've actually run out of time. We had a great conversation here. You've answered a lot of questions that I've had, and I'm sure the audience has had, and you've educated us a lot about things that maybe we weren't aware of. So I really appreciate you taking the time to do that with us today. And I will get those resource links and all from you. We'll post those up on the YouTube site, and I'll try and put them out with other social media related to this particular podcast. So, you know, Dr. Carstensen, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day, and I appreciate the work that you're doing to help educate us all about sleep and breathing and just breathing issues in general.
Well, this is a wonderful opportunity. I can't believe we've spent all of our time. But yeah, folks out there, the critical thing is you have to take every breath, every day, every night, and make it your best. And don't stop until you're able to do that. And there's multiple resources, physicians, dentists, ear, nose, and throat doctors, there's therapists. But just make sure you can breathe well, because your brain wants you to breathe well.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.